This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Margaret Marshall is the curator of theatre and popular entertainment for the Australian Performing Arts Collection at the Arts Centre in Melbourne, joining us. Hello, Margaret.
Hello, how are you?
Well, firstly, did circuses always look like the circuses we know it today?
Look, there's been various changes over time. Changes with developments as times have evolved. But I guess essentially some traditional elements have been there all the time. So circuses are really about demonstrating physical skills. So that's continued in the way that, the entertainment is presented.
Hmm.
Usually presented in a ring, one or more ring with a surrounding audience. And the other key element that's really remained is that tents have been used for a very long time. Not always, but for many years, particularly for touring circuses because of the ease of putting them up and down. And
so,
that continues as well.
So really within that format there have been all sorts of changes, and whether or not, because originally did most circuses in the beginning have animals?
They mainly had horses to begin with.
Yeah.
The equestrian arts were the real key to the early circuses, and the skill of the riders was, what everyone came to see. And the reason for a ring was that the horses could canter around in a circle, and the centrifugal force helped with the tricks that the performers were doing on the backs of horses. It enabled them to, keep their equilibrium, and the magic of physics made it possible for them to do tricks. So, horses were the main element, and then other animals became introduced sort of in intervening years.
Did the circuses that we have in Australia come about as a result of touring circuses coming here from overseas and then us developing our own circus culture, or did we develop our own independently?
No, it was really influenced by overseas performers and really drawing on Philip Astley's amphitheatre that was set up in London, and there would have been people that came out to Australia that had seen or been to that circus performance and therefore sort of knew what a circus looked like. And the very first, what is considered Australia's first circus was in 1847 in Launceston and set up by Robert Radford, who was an English-born jockey and trainer and who moved to Australia in 1841.
So there
was definitely an influence from overseas and a real tradition.
And were a lot of the initial performers, like the tightrope and the people on the trapeze and that sort of thing, were they overseas artists that came here and toured with the circuses here?
Often, yes. In fact, at Radford's circus, there were two really key performers who were in Australia. One was a acrobat called John Jones, who became Matthew St. Leon and set up a circus. And he was actually a former convict and had received a ticket of leave just before Radford set up his circus. And he was an acrobat, so he already had the skills in that sense, and he also learnt the equestrian skills later on. And the other person was James Henry Ashton, who was also an equestrian, and he set up Ashton Circus in 1851. And really from those two performers stem so many other circus families.
And because it was a family tradition, and they trained within the families, they would train up.
Yeah. I mean, obviously there were sort of other acts incorporated and people joined the circus, but the family tradition is a really strong one, and it's about the passing on of skills through the generations. They seem to train up their children very young and share the skills that they had and travel together, obviously, which makes sense as a family that you would do that together as a company.
We'll go through some calls. Lots of people wanting to join us. Jules, hello, Jules.
Hi, Trevor and Margaret. The circus that's most thrilling these days is Cirque du Soleil, of course, but when I was a little girl growing up on the northern beaches of Sydney, it was such a thrill when Worth Circus or Ashton Circus set up. They would set up in a field behind the beach and they'd put up their tent and you could sneak down there after school and look at all the animals. And they had lions and they had elephants and, of course, we had the tightrope walkers and the clowns, and it was just a wonderful thing. It seemed to happen about once a year. I'm talking in the 1950s.
Well, I can remember in the mid-60s that they would come to town once a year.
Yeah, yeah. And you could buy fairy floss.
I know. It was just a dream. Hey, Margaret, so did they have a definite circuit that they would run on?
A circuit,
yeah.
Look, I think it sort of became more and more planned in the beginning, sort of in the early years when the gold rush was on. There was a lot of touring circuses, and it was a bit of a mixed bag of where you went and when. And obviously, you didn't want to collide with another circus and have competition. And I think over the years, the circuits tended to settle, but there were sort of different ways. The circuses travelled, and so Worth Circus, which this caller's just mentioned, they travelled by rail. They were Australia's largest circus for many years, and they travelled on a special train that they had and commissioned, which would have been very expensive, but it was a much easier way of travelling. And that meant that they really went to major cities and towns that had stations, whereas other circuses travelled by road, first of all by wagon and then later on by car or other vehicles, and they tended to do more of the regional and country areas and moved around in those sorts of parts of Australia, the more rural outback areas.
So there were a lot of, because when I think of it, I mean, I can only remember two or three, but so there used to be a lot of travelling circuses.
They've sort of come and gone over the time. Really, the 1870s to 90s, we had a lot of American circuses touring coming in, and that was, off the back of the wealth of the gold fields and the audiences that were there. And then Australia started to establish our own circuses and, mixed fortunes along the way. But there were probably, four or five main ones for most of the years up to the 60s.
Did each state tend to have their own, or did they travel around the country? I guess that would change depending on travel, I guess.
It did, yes. And so, for example, Holden Brothers here in Victoria, we're largely Victoria, New South Wales based, and maybe a little bit further afield, whereas Worth's went all around Australia on their train. So, a bit of a mix there.
Hello, Ginny.
Oh, hi.
Yes, Jenny.
No, I had a story about Worth Circus when it was located on the Arts Centre site. My mother had been a victim of the polio in 1932 and then had travelled to Victoria for treatment and then lived here. And my grandmother used to tell fascinating stories about when she was paralysed. And one of the ones she always told was she got tickets to the circus at Worth's when it was on St Kilda Road there. And she was paralysed in this long wicker pram. So she arrived early and she was lashed by a splint into the pram and then they'd lash the pram onto the bleachers. And anyway, the circus started and the lion got out.
Oh, my gosh.
And the tent was full, packed full of American GIs. And Nan used to say, they were overpaid, oversexed and over here. And all these GIs had taken local girls to the circus. And when the lion got out, all the American soldiers just disappeared. And my grandmother used to go, they can run so fast. Anyway, so here was my grandmother, and so my mother was lashed onto the bleachers, and they couldn't go anywhere. And my tough old grandmother, she got out the enamel bedpan from underneath the pram, and she stood there in defence of her daughter. By the way, the lion was pretty tame and it was caught, and so nothing bad happened, but she always used to talk about going to the circus and defending with this enamel bedpan. So, yeah, a very funny moment.
Great story.
And good on her for showing up all the US soldiers.
That's right. She, for years and years, she used to go, they've run so far.
Thank you, Jenny. Deborah said, did people recall the Tommy Hanlon circus? Tommy Hanlon, I remember from television.
Yes, I think he was associated with Silver Circus.
Okay.
I think he was one of those in the 70s. So, yeah, I remember him sort of being the face of circus for a while.
Don, hello.
G'day, Trevor. There you go.
Yes, Don.
When my youngest daughter was 5 or 6 years old, not long started primary school, the circus came to town. We're living out in Western Sydney. And the horse come out and did a few tricks, and then they flicked her out of the audience to get on the horse and ride around. They put a harness on her, and the horses run around in circles. And at the predetermined point, they pulled the rope, and she's gone flying up in the air. And her knickers came down. And she's plus 30 plus now, and I remind her every now and then about it, and have a good laugh.
Yeah, there was always, because thank you, Don. I've heard so many stories about people being chosen from the crowd and having jokes played on them by clowns. It seemed to be one of the major things within the circuses, Margaret.
Well, clowning's very much a part of the tradition of circus, and that goes back, you know, way back to you know, strolling minstrels in the Middle Ages, and that whole mime and comedic element of performance, and that's morphed into the circus tradition. And the clowns, I guess, were really there to, you know, make the crowd have a great time and to fill in the moments between the more physical acts and really, yeah, create that fun atmosphere.
Because they're also more than that now, if you take a look at the modern circuses, because there are no animals involved in the modern circuses, a lot of the clowning now is incredibly important to a modern circus.
Absolutely, and Circus Oz is a great example of that, and that they really, you know, grab onto that larrikin spirit of Australia and don't take themselves too seriously, and humour is a very big part of their circus performance.
And I think just about all of Circus Oz are all clowns, but they manage to incorporate all of the shows and the acts and within that clowning.
With all sorts of amazing skills.
Hello, Graham.
G'day, Tony. I remember the circus in the 50s coming to Phillip Island in Western Port Bay. They had a rickety old suspension bridge which had a high arch so that shark boats could get underneath it. And so when the circus came ready for New Year's weekend, they had to unload all the elephants so they could walk. They'd have to walk across the bridge, and it was a very long bridge, because the bridge couldn't bear the load of the truck and the elephants. And so a few of the clowns would do a bit in this, and so there'd be a file of elephants going across the arched bridge from one side to the other, and all of us kids and so forth who were camping and holidaying there just to sit along the edge of the bridge and watch this animal parade every year.
Look, it's because we talked about the community and the significance of the community, Margaret, and it was like a travelling village almost?
Yes, it pretty much would have been. You know, they had not only the performers but all the animal handlers and the, you know, the people that put up the tents and did all that sort of manual labour. You know, it was a whole community, as you say, and they lived together and worked together and travelled together.
Margaret, you mentioned that in the beginning there were people from overseas who were big names. Did we have our own big names on the circuits?
We did, and certainly, you know, people like James Henry Ashton, who I mentioned before, became, you know, really well known. But we had a couple of really amazing Australians who had great success overseas, and you know, were known here, but they were particularly known overseas. Mm. And they were Mae Worth, who was a young equestrian performer with Worth Circus, and she went over and had amazing success in America with the Ringling and Barnum and Bailey Circus. And also Concolino, who is a tightrope performer, known as the Wizard of the Wire, and he likewise had great success in America.
So there was that idea that you became successful in Australia and you could actually continue your career by going overseas.
Yes, not a huge number of people did that, and certainly not to the level of Mayworth and Concolino. They really are the big stars of circus from the early 20th century. There was definitely cultural exchange going on, those two are the ones that stand out as having, you know, they became really high-paid, leading, highly billed artists in America.
I think when you look at it, now quite a few Australian artists go from circusing in Australia to things like Cirque du Soleil. It sort of happens a little bit more now as well.
Absolutely, yes, definitely. I think they're sort of... The way the world has opened up and people travel and move around, that's obviously increased over the years.
Yeah, because I think one of our Olympic trampolinists who won a gold medal, I think who won a medal at one of the Olympics is now trampolinist with Cirque du Soleil, or was for a period of time.
Right.
Hello, Rob.
Top of the morning to you, TC.
Yes, and you.
Fruitfly Circus out of Albury, Wodonga.
Yep.
It was done with a whole heap of kids. I was a young fella at the stage at Albury Primary School when they come through looking for people who were interested to join the circus.
Frying Flute Fly Circus ended up providing a lot of performers for Circus Oz.
It does, and it still does for around the world. I could name probably half a dozen people who have been through various circuses around the world.
Oh, from the fruit fly?
From the fruit fly.
They were yeah, go on.
One of them's, I can't think of her surname at the moment, was Tanya. She did what was called the Spanish spider up on a thing. And she was seven or eight when she did it. She was the youngest performer to do that act in the world.
Rob, thank you. The Fruit Fly Circus did a terrific job and was a wonderful place for training up and also getting a good education, Margaret.
Absolutely, and that sort of, you know, development is part of the new circus that Circus Oz is part of as well, where it's less of the family tradition and that sort of, you know, travelling together as a family and more of a... there's more sort of formed training avenues, like with the Flying Fruit Fly Circus and also now the National Institute of Circus Arts, NICA. There's more of a sense of circus as a profession or potentially as a profession. Not necessarily all the kids that go to Flying Fruit Flies would end up being circus performers, but it's a shift away from that sort of handed down tradition through families and more of a formal education opportunity.
Emily, who joins us on the program every now and then, she might be asleep now, but she quite often talks about her time in the circus in her, she would have been about six or seven as a child. But this is during the Depression, and she was saying how difficult it was for circuses to survive through that time.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like all performing arts, but particularly circus, they're affected by the times, you know, in an economic levels of the country, as you know, we're seeing it obviously with COVID-19 at the moment. Circuses are having a tough time, but yeah, the Depression, the world wars, changes you know, in technology, like the introduction of television was you know, had dire consequence on circuses in the 50s and 60s. So yeah, they're very susceptible to changing social times.
Yeah, but it would have been this family nature of those circuses that would have kept them together and for them to survive.
Yeah, probably. I would say that there would have been a lot of tenacity because they were family.
A couple of texts saying that Silver's was definitely Tommy Hanlon's circus. I was friends with his daughter April, and one day at her home in Turek, we had the great pleasure of playing with a baby lion from the circus, says Dorothy. He's now in Torquay. Hello, Graham.
Yeah, g'day. How are you?
Good, Graham.
In the 60s, I lived in northwest Sydney, and where there's now a shopping centre, there's a big block of land, and about once a year a circus of a different breed would come. Ashton's. I worked for The very first time I sort of snuck away from school and asked if they needed a worker, and I ended up selling sweets, and I became the obviously a specialist sweet seller at Ashton's and Bullen's and eventually Soul Brothers. So I got to see the circus. It became a bit of a critic, I suppose, but Bullen's, I think, were based at Warragamba. I think that Lion Safari was Bullen's, and I think because it was within reaching, old Mr. Bullen used to come in a white Rolls Royce, and we used to actually shovel elephant poo into his Rolls Royce to take back to the garden, which was, I think it was one of my second jobs, shoveling elephant poop into a Rolls Royce. But and one of the circuses, an elephant got away and knocked down fences and all that sort of stuff. So it was a bit of excitement around the place. But I remember I used to get about $1 a night.
Did you travel with them or just whoever came to town?
Yeah, when it came into thing, I just sort of, they'd put up signs about a few weeks before. And so when they arrived, I'd sneak off school and, maybe I was enterprising, I'd get this job. Probably a packet of sweets was 20 cents or something. I might have got 5 cent tip here and there. I actually got paid, like I said, $1 a night.
Well, that's all right if you became a sweets expert.
Yeah, somewhat. And it was just, as a kid, it was a lot of fun because you got the smell of the grease paint and I got to watch all the shows and all that sort of stuff. So.
Oh, it'd be fun.
Yeah, well, that was it. Anyway, thanks a lot.
Good on you. Thank you. Margaret, when we started to see animals having to leave the circus, especially things like lions and wild animals, how drastically did that affect the circuses?
Oh, quite drastically. There are still circuses performing with animals now, but those very exotic animals, like, as you say, the elephants and the lions and tigers and seals and polar bears, that really changed the face of what a circus had become known to be when those animals were no longer sort of deemed appropriate.
Do we know where they went, what they actually did with the animals?
I don't know. Hopefully they farmed them out somewhere where they could live out a happy retirement.
They probably would have gone to zoos.
They would have had to. I mean, they couldn't have gone into the wild, so because they were, domesticated.
Or maybe Mr. Bullen actually put them all the lions.
He might have taken the lions and tigers.
I went to one of those when I was a kid, Bullen's Lion Park. They had one in Wanneroo in WA.
Right.
It was terrible.
Yeah.
Scary.
Yeah, I imagine they would be quite frightening.
Elaine, hello.
Good morning. I have a story from when I was growing up in a small town in Sheffield. The circus used to come around quite frequently, and the house that we lived in backed onto a big park where the circus was always held. And the elephants would roam around during the day, and we had an old dog, and he got quite excited, and the elephant swung its trunk over the fence one day and trumpeted loudly, and our poor old dog took off, and we didn't see him for 2 days. I don't know where he ran to, but he got such a fright that he just took off.
Don't blame him.
Yeah, I don't know that.
Did you always like it when it came to town alone?
We loved it, yes. We always loved it, and particularly living right next door to it, we used to wander around amongst the all the goings-on and really have a great time, yeah.
Look, thank you. That was the thing, Margaret. It was because it didn't happen very often, it was a big event, and if it was a small town, everybody would go.
Absolutely, yeah. And the build-up of excitement was a big part of the circus coming, so that the caller that was talking about how the signs went up a few weeks ahead, the circuses actually had what they called advance agents who went ahead of the circus of 2 to 4 weeks and put up the signage and handed out flyers and organised the licensing for where the tent was going to be put up, went and spoke to the shopkeepers and made sure there were going to be enough sausages at the butcher's and enough bread at the bakery, all in preparation for the circus coming. And then when the circus arrived, there was often a parade with the musicians drumming up the excitement, and the people from the towns would see this happening. And so there's sort of this build of excitement and then the actual performances as well. So a very big deal, particularly in country areas where, you know, entertainment was slim on the ground.
Because it's sort of its time, though, because, and you're right, I mean, there we would see circus stuff on the films or on telly, but seeing it live was different, and they may not have been as spectacular, perhaps, as some of the things that you might have seen in a movie or on telly, but it was seeing it live and being that close to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the basis of circus entertainment is that sort of awe and breathtaking skill that you're watching, whether it's from humans or, you know, in some cases animals. It really is about the wonder of some amazing feat being performed in front of you, and the risk that's involved in that as well. So it's very exciting.
And then things like Cirque du Soleil came along, and in some ways it sort of destroyed it a little bit, because everything was so big and huge that you would think that anything alongside it wouldn't survive. Although it was very expensive, and a lot of people couldn't go because it cost so much.
Exactly, and that's a real difference too, because circus has traditionally been a very affordable form of entertainment compared to others. The Cirque du Soleil sort of companies are very slick and very, you know, polished and beautiful performances, great entertainment, but it's a different vibe.
It is very different, because when you take a look at it, it's very big and very grand, and I'm not going to say that the tricks aren't necessarily that hard, but they're very grand and spectacular. But sometimes the smaller tricks and the smaller things that are done, like in Circus Oz, are quite often more difficult, but they don't look as showy.
Yes, and I think with Circus Oz, they've retained a rawness that is part of what we would think of as traditional circus. So they've kind of kept a groundedness and... I guess it's a bit of the Aussie spirit of just being straight up and who you are.
Yeah, it's larrikin circus.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I like it because it's ours.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think we're all a bit biased in that way.
Hello, Shelley.
Oh, hello.
Yes, Shelley.
I'm just remembering Ashton's, I think, in Richmond in Melbourne. It was near a railway, so they would park themselves in this, you know, quite a big park area near the railway, and we'd go as young people. But I also rang up because I had an aunt who's dead now called Diana Mogensen, and she did a whole series of the Ashton Circus acts with permission and specialising in Nikki. That's who I remember, Nikki Ashton. And so she did some portraits of Nikki, and also did quite a few of the circus acts, including the high rope, the tightrope, and also picturing the acrobats and the actors and performers getting ready. So they were kind of in dressing rooms, you know, with particular putting on costumes and stuff. Not to do with nudity, but just trying to give a good picture of their lifestyle. And they would be in Melbourne somewhere. And Diana died in about late 70s, late 90s. I just thought I'd mention that because Margaret might know how to get hold of even some pictures of Ashton Circus.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but look, thank you. That's the other thing, Margaret, is the other forms of arts that come off the back of circus, and whether it be the visions of circus, the music of circus. There are so many other forms of arts associated with circus.
Yeah, that's right. And the other area is vaudeville and variety. There's a real crossover there. I mean, they're forms of entertainment that we don't have so much these days either, but a lot of the skills such as, you know, juggling and acrobatics and the comedy and the rope spinning, all those sorts of forms of entertainment crossed between circus and vaudeville. And I guess performing in vaudeville theatres enabled performers to work through the winter when it was too cold and wet to be touring, and also gave them more stable employment. So it's a really interesting crossover there.
Sarah saying, we send our three sons to a primary school with school circuses. They all learnt to unicycle. It was brilliant. There were so many different skills that were wonderful for young people to do with circus, because it meant that if they weren't good at sport, there were other things that they could do within circus. It was great. Yeah. Hello, Audrey.
Oh, good morning, Trevor. I belong to a group called VISE, Volunteers for Isolated Students Education. And normally we go out to remote properties and for 6 weeks and live with the family and teach there. But there's a circus known as Silvers, and we have sent volunteers to them as well. And we travel with the circus. For some people can stay for a whole year. And the circus has a fantastic caravan set up with two living quarters for the volunteers and a wonderful classroom for the children in the circus. And so the volunteers travel with that and are so well looked after by the circus family.
How long has it been going for, Audrey?
Well, I know of it maybe for 7 or 8 years,
yeah. But
maybe longer than that. I don't know.
What a great thing to have, Margaret.
It sounds fantastic. And it would be, you know, real education in many different ways.
Did the kids get educated as they travelled around with family, or was their learning circus?
I think they would have had rudimentary education, you know, what they could do. And, you know, that's one of the things with circus and other, travelling performers, where they are probably less formally educated than many others. And there's always been a bit of a sense of snobbery about that. Circus is considered to be a fairly low form of entertainment, and part of that's about the sort of unconventional lifestyle and lack of education that sort of goes alongside it.
Yeah, fooey to that. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Trev, how are you, mate?
Good, Neil.
Yeah, my grandfather, who's been dead quite a while, I'm 86, he was a bandmaster for either Worth or Ashmore Circus in southeast Queensland. He was a bandmaster, and they used to call him Professor Gagan.
Wow.
So I just got out of bed and tried to look through. I've got the Gagan history, but I just can't find it.
That's okay. What stories do you know of him? What did he say about it?
Oh, well, he used to just talk, because he used to live with us before he died, but in southeast Queensland, in Killarney. But he was mainly in, well, they started in Dalby, and Gagan's was called G-G-E-N in those days, but then it went to G-A-G-E-N. He just talked about the circus life and the band, and he was all that era of older Gagans. My father was a bandmaster in Killarney. My brother and I, Ray, who rings you a bit, he just talked about the life which they enjoyed and being a bandmaster.
But did he play an instrument, Neil? What did he play?
He was a trumpet player.
Yep.
Yeah, a cornet. Yeah, yeah. But they could play anything, like banjos, guitars. My father could, and we haven't got a note in us, but that's the way it is, mate. Yeah. I just listened to you and I thought, well, I better know what he was saying about any circuses having bands, but he was the bandmaster, the one probably in the 1920s, I suppose.
Neil, I'm glad you mentioned that, because we haven't mentioned the bands, but they're significant from then all the way through till now, Margaret.
Absolutely. Music's a really big part of circus entertainment, and might not think of that initially because we sort of picture the physical skills, but it's not a silent situation. There's music involved, and, the bands would have played throughout the performances and, created a really wonderful atmosphere. And they also had that really important role of announcing the arrival of the circus coming into the towns, playing their loud instruments, banging the big bass drums, and really making quite a scene as the circuses entered.
And if you go and see Circus Oz, then you'll see the musicians performing on Highwire, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, and they've sort of adopted a much more modern sound, but they've incorporated that tradition of having music within the performance.
It's been a pleasure talking to you about the circus today, Margaret. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been lovely.
Margaret Marshall, the curator of theatre and popular entertainment for the Australian Performing Arts Collection at the Arts Centre in Melbourne.